Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnar Blog. Good evening, James.
Good evening, Andrew. It's Arscast After Dark.
Yeah, it's a late one because...
A sexy one.
I don't know about that, but...
That's TBC. We'll find out about
that. Yeah. You've been busy all day. I know you don't like to talk about this, but you have been away, I believe, filming on the new Star Wars franchise. It's top secret stuff. It's called Yoda's Houseboy, and you are the houseboy. Nobody thinks about how Yoda ever got his groceries. That guy.
Yeah, listen, I've signed a lot of NDAs. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but I guess, yeah, I'm Yoda's houseboy. And Yoda's there. He's ordering me around with his funny little voice, you know.
Yeah.
Feed you, Rab. Stuff like that. And I'm doing it for him.
That's it.
It's beck and call. It's going to be massive. It's going to be a massive Disney franchise.
High concept stuff, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of meta. It's like, you know, it's an aspect of Yoda we've never seen, and a lot of his houseboy that we've never seen.
Well, like you said, it is a sexy episode already. So
that's true. Yeah. I don't want to give anything the game away about where it all goes, but let's just say there's a spark between Yoda and his houseboy, a forbidden love. That crosses a professional divide.
Oh my goodness! I don't think this is going to get any better. Actually, this episode, I think we should just quit here.
Really?
Yeah, I think this could be just quite as good as it gets.
No, funnily enough, I have been filming on Yoda's Houseboy. Let's call it Project Yoda's Houseboy. And the director and the actor that I was in the scene with, both Arsenal fans. So I had this slightly surreal thing. And who knew of me and my other works? I had this such a real thing where, like, director would yell, cut, and then she'd sort of sidle over and sort of ask me, you know, are we going to sign Osimhen from Napoli? So I've been doing double duty today.
Fair enough. I mean, did they know about the podcast? Was it a case of, like, cut, we're not sure about that one, but we know you've got to get back and do the Arscast Extra, so I guess that one will do.
I suspect there was probably an element of that. They were probably thinking that was a substandard acting performance, but, you know, the people need the podcast. Let's get this guy in a cab and get him home. I'm here now.
It's all about Yoda anyway, really. It's not
to be honest, yeah, and a lot of that's going to be CGI, so... Especially some of the things they've got him doing to the house. I mean, you know, there's no puppeteer that will sign up for that.
No. You have to put your hand in some strange places when you're a puppeteer anyway. So, look, it's been busy and we are here in the evening. It seems strange to record in the evening. The sun is shining through my office window right now. Bank holiday here. Is bank holiday there as well? Is it still bank holiday? You've had about six.
No, it's not our bank holiday anymore.
No, you had about six in a row, didn't you?
We had Thursday and Friday.
Right. Yeah,
okay. Because we've still got a queen. Don't know if you know about that. But we're all back to work today, trying to oust the Prime Minister. So it's business as usual.
Right. Well, nothing quite as scandalous as that going on over here.
It's a bank holiday there today.
It is bank holiday, yeah. June bank holiday weekend. So been taking it kind of easy. The weather wasn't great. It was nice Saturday, but yesterday was just miserable, raining all day. So I stayed in. I watched, binge-watched a couple of episodes. Well, the episodes of The Boys. Have you watched that superhero series?
Interesting that you mentioned that. I've sort of been thinking maybe I should watch it. Is it good?
It is good. It's a bit it's entertaining. It is quite gruesome. And I have to say that in the first part of the first episode of the new series, there is a bit that just, you know, you get to 50 years of age and you think you've probably seen pretty much all there is to see in terms of on-screen violence or whatever it might be. But there is a bit that I have to say it took me by surprise. But it is a good show. It is very violent. It's sort of a twist on the superhero thing.
Yeah. Interestingly, yeah. My friend, the Arsenal supporting comedian Annie McGrath, was acting this weekend in a kind of immersive theatre show based on The Boys.
Okay.
It was kind of like, you know, I think it was an Amazon tie-in or something similar. And she just kept sending me, it was like, you know, you wander into a basement and there's actors in there and you kind of have an experience, but she kept just sending me pictures of like bloody corpses. So I guess that's the vibe, right? There's a lot of blood and gore.
There is. There's a lot of exploding people. Without necessarily bombs, but certainly, you know, when they explode, there is a lot of blood and guts and what have you. But
is this a recommendation from you, or you're not sure? You're on the fence.
No, I like it. I like the first two series. It took me a while to get into the second one. I was a little bit humming and hawing, but I think it's going to go in a particularly dark direction, which is you know, it looks like it's going to be entertaining. So yeah, I'm on board with this one.
I've been watching series four of Stranger Things. Nobody asked, but I'm just telling you. And okay, it's excellent.
Right, I couldn't get beyond season two of Stranger Things.
It's a shame, actually, because I think two and three are a bit of a dip from one, and four has really come strong. But yeah, I hear you on that. Okay. But I'm enjoying series.
All right. Well, maybe I'll revisit.
You know, it's the summer, guys. What do you want from us? You're going to get TV recommendations mainly.
Well, this is it. There isn't a great deal of football going on, but I guess we're going to have to dive right into the little bits and bobs.
The listeners are screaming into the void, Gnabry news! Bring us the Gnabry news!
What is the Gnabry news? Do we have Gnabry news? We should have like a jingle for that.
The jingle could say, there is no Gnabry news. And to be honest, I think we'd get a lot of use out of that jingle over the course of the summer.
Okay, well then we're going to have to move on because it's all about Big Billy. Big Bill himself. Yes, he did an interview at the weekend. I thought this was quite interesting. That, like, people were on tenterhooks in a way. Okay. It's like, what's going to happen? What's he going to say in this interview with Telefoot or whoever it was that he spoke to in France? Will he say, Arsenal is my club forever, or I want to stay in Marseille forever, whatever it is? And it was like, it's a bit weird because, like, he does have a contract with us, and it would be really odd if he just went on TV and said, nah, I want to go somewhere else. Get me out of here. I don't want to go back. That would be weird, right?
I hear you, but didn't he kind of do that about a fortnight ago at the...
Maybe, but I mean, I think he was just sort of at the end of his loan spell with Marseille, and he was, you know, I think he was just trying to...
Trying to be everything to everyone.
Exactly.
He's trying to keep everybody happy. I mean, I'm joking, but I do think... There is an element of that.
Of course, because, you know, you never quite know what's going to happen in football. But I think he's just sort of at the end of his spell with Marseille, had a very good time, connected with the club, connected with the fans, wants to say the right thing for them. And I think you can interpret it as, well, he said this nice thing about Marseille, therefore he must hate Arsenal. I don't, you know, the two things aren't mutually exclusive, you know? But I did find it quite curious. Like, this is a 21-year-old guy, really promising player, really talented, everything else. And, you know, people are just like, oh, what is going to happen with him? And then he said, well, I'm going to go back. I've got 2 years left. I want to show this great club and these great fans what I'm all about, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, well, of course. Unless you're like really badly advised, and look, it's, you know, some players are quite badly advised, but he doesn't strike me as one of those. He doesn't strike me as an unprofessional guy in any way. I mean, this was basically what he was going to say, right?
I think so. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, what he said, it's been reported sort of as quite definitive, like kind of case closed. That's it. He's going back.
Oh, you're going to piss in people's chips now, right?
No. I mean, listen, it definitely looks more like that than it did a few weeks ago because, you know, it's not just what he said. It's what Mikel Arteta has said publicly. And both of those things have been a bit lacking. But it's interesting. I sort of was thinking about this. I knew we were going to talk about it on the show today. And then I read your blog this morning, Monday morning, and I was like, oh, you've sort of said what I would have said. But like, I know that I said many times, several times on here, that I didn't have a great deal of confidence that he'll come back and play for Arsenal.
Yes, yeah, some people did bring that up, in fairness.
Yeah, yeah. And I promise that what I'm about to say is not just me clinging on to some idea that I might be right, because I don't want to be right. I want to see William Saliba at Arsenal. But I am still sceptical, shall I say, about this all working out for that outcome.
Okay. Can I ask you this then? Because we do have questions, and we had lots of questions about him. And one of the questions that we got is from, let me have a look here, from Dr. Generational, PhD, MBBS, BSc, who's at Just Rankings 20 on Twitter. And he said, considering we're at the 2 years left re-sign or sell window with William Saliba, what do you honestly think happens with him? Because I think most of us listening to this would be like, it'd be great if he came back and really, you know, settled into life at Arsenal, became a big Arsenal player, all of that kind of stuff. But I don't think you can look at his situation without taking into account that contractual element. So he has 2 years left. If nothing happens this summer and we hang on to him, we end up next summer in that situation that we all hate, where a player's got a year left on his contract. We're fretting that A, we won't sign him and he's going to leave for free, or B, like, all the power goes to the player in the contract negotiation situation. So there have been reports that Arsenal are going to try and get him to sign a new contract. I mean, do you think that this is, as much as like what we want, what the club want, what Mikel Arteta might want, et cetera, that this maybe is the, not the deciding factor, but very key to what happens?
I think it will be a big factor. I mean, what I would say is, how can he sign that contract? I can't see him signing a contract without getting some sense of his standing within the squad.
Do you think that can happen via discussions?
Yeah.
Or does he need to, like, would it, I mean, I don't think it would be unreasonable for him to say, well, look, I like these assurances that you've given me, but I want to sit here for a while and let's see where we are in December and see how involved I am and see how much I've played. I don't think that would be unreasonable for him or any player, really.
Yeah, and if I'm his agent, and I think he is quite well advised, to be honest, I think he's conducted himself pretty well through some pretty difficult circumstances. I don't know that I would advise him, unless the financial terms are incredibly favourable, to sign that contract until, you know, he has some experience, until games are happening and he gets some sense of where he is in the reckoning. Because I just think words at this point won't mean that much to him. I mean, who knows what he was told when he first signed for the club back in 2019 or whatever it was. You know, in a year, you'll come over to London and you'll be with us and you'll be an important part of the team. That didn't come to pass. So I don't think words are going to swing it at this point. I mean, I guess we say, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but it is a really complex and interesting situation as well. My thing is, like, I think what Saliba's most recent interview and what Mikel Arteta said publicly lead me to believe is that we will at least get to the point of Saliba turning up for pre-season training with Arsenal and spending some time with the group. And I have to be honest and say, I wasn't sure we'd get there.
Okay.
I thought, you know, a decision might be made, a negative decision, shall we say, prior to that. So I think the fact that, you know, the fact that that looks like it's going to happen, to me, suggests at least both parties are sort of open to this working out.
I mean, do you think, as a club, Arsenal can take the gamble? Let's say they sit him down and say, look, we really want you to be part of this club. And he says, great, but I want to see how much I play before I commit. right? Yeah. And that those are...
Isn't that really reasonable if he says that?
I don't think it's unreasonable at all.
No.
However, it is a gamble because you're in the situation where next year he could get to a year out and then sit in his contract and leave on a Bosman the year after.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he's happy with how much he's playing or not. We know stuff can go on behind the scenes. You know, is that a gamble that Arsenal can take given some of the deals that we've seen done in recent years where players who would have had some significant value, players that we spent a lot of money on, not in every case, but we've also had some players who've come through the academy or come through from a very young age, have, you know, left for nothing. And you're thinking, well, there's Ozil, there's Aubameyang, there's Lacazette, there's Danny Welbeck, there's Aaron Ramsey, there's Jack Wilshere. You know, there is a list of players that have gone for nothing. Yeah. And that at some point you as a football club have to say, well, we can't let that happen. We have to maybe make a difficult decision, one that we don't want to make, but in the interests of maximizing, you know, the value of a player at a key time, well, you know, people might not like it, but this is what we're going to have to do. Or you say, look, we want you to stay. Here's the contract offer. If you want to see how much you play, you know, that is a calculated risk, I guess, based on... I suppose external factors come into play then, because I guess when you get to 12 months out, there'll be people talking to his agent saying, you know what, we'll take him. We'll take him in a year's time, or we'll, you know, take him for a slightly knockdown fee with 12 months to go, that kind of way. It is a complex one for Arsenal, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, you describe it as a gamble. I think it is a gamble. But I think it's a gamble the club may have to take if they want to give it a go with Saliba. I just can't... Again, I might be proved wrong about this, but I find it hard to envisage a scenario where he has the confidence and feels that the management team at Arsenal have the confidence in him for him to put pen to paper on a new deal at this point. But, you know, the other thing to say is it doesn't have to be next summer, you know. If the first few months of the season see him settling into the group, settling into life in England, getting game time, if he's selected for the France World Cup squad, you know, there might be an opportune moment at that point to do a deal, to do a new contract. And I think realistically, that is what something Arsenal may, a sort of bullet they may have to bite if they want it to work with this player. Because I agree, it's a bit of a financial risk, and you risk having an asset of depreciating value. But I'm not sure I see a way around it. I suppose the way around it is he's for sufficiently convinced to sign a new contract. But I just, well, my instinct tells me that would be very difficult at this point in time. Can you see him signing a contract right now?
I mean, I would be surprised. I'd be really surprised. But, you know, maybe they are persuasive. Maybe they can persuade him and convince him that, look, we want you to stay and we want you to play and we think you can grow here and be part of a team that and a club, hopefully, that is going places. And I suppose what I would say as well, and this is a point I made in the blog, is that the Arsenal that he is coming into right now feels much more attuned or in line with his age profile, his qualities, his potential, than the Arsenal he came into in 2019 when we were still going through the Mustafi and Socrates and David Luiz stuff, you know, which, yeah, look, I think I've said before, like the idea of a loan for a 20-year-old centre-half is not one that really bothers me too much. But of course, his whole situation, there's been a lot of baggage about it and everything else. But like if he has to be convinced, I don't think that's unreasonable because, you know, he's gone to Marseille, he's played every week, he's in the French squad. You know, if he comes into Arsenal, let's say he has a slow start to his season for whatever reason and maybe just misses out on the World Cup, what does that do?
Yeah.
You know, there are things that Arsenal are going to have to manage or think about that maybe just go beyond I don't know how you express this, like, because obviously the manager and the coaching staff make the best decisions that they make for each game to try and win the game, but they've got to think about some of the other things that go on as well, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that World Cup really looms large in terms of Saliba's future. The fact that it comes in the winter as well, you know, he kind of needs to hit the ground running in game time terms if he is to keep that place. And, you know, normally, if you're looking at the situation, Arsenal have got an established centre-back pairing of Gabriel and Ben White. They're bringing in a young player, younger than those guys, who's been out on loan. You'd think, well, you bed him in, you know, you'd give him time. Maybe by the end of the season, he's playing more games. That, I don't think that's going to cut it for Saliba. Maybe the Europa League is kind of the saving grace. You know, that's the thing that means that he will start enough games to be in that contention, and Deschamps will, you know, be satisfied with that.
Yeah.
The other thing about the contract is that money does ultimately talk. I mean, you know, I can say about the player needs to be persuaded, but when I say money talks, it's not just the fact of the wage, but if a club are prepared to put you into a certain bracket of salary, that is usually a very good indicator of what sort of playing time you're expected to get. So if they put him on a starter's salary, for example, then that might change things. But I'm cautiously optimistic. How can you not be after what he has said and what Arteta has said? I just feel that between him turning up for training on day one at London Colney and the end of the transfer window, I still think I have a nagging feeling there are still sort of questions to be answered.
Doesn't that then, in some ways, demand a relatively quick decision? Because I think it would be fair to say that Arsenal do need a central defender. I know you've reported that they're maybe after a left-sided centre-half, but Saliba as well can play in that position, has played in that position. So he could tick boxes across the back line. And I wonder as well about perhaps the versatility of some of the players that we've got back there. You know, Ben White can play centre-half and right-back. Saliba can play left centre-half, right centre half, and he can play in a three. Gabriel, also Kieran Tierney, can play left back, and he can play in a back three. Tomiyasu can play as right back. He can play as a central defender as well. So I wonder if that kind of versatility is something that they're thinking about. But, you know, if there is something, in inverted commas, amiss with the Saliba situation, maybe they have to sort it quickly, because we are going to need to bring in another central defender one way or the other then.
I do think we need, certainly at least one new central defender. And Max, who's Rad Schooner on Twitter, said, is William Saliba the most like a new signing player of all time? But he really would be. I mean, you know, if we were buying William Saliba at this point in time,
sure,
we'd all be pretty excited about that.
Given
what he's done in Ligue 1 this season. So, make no mistake, it's an addition that would really strengthen our options. I think it would give us options, as you suggest, with the versatility of some of these guys, different combinations. I think we're going to need that over the coming season. I wouldn't, you know, discount Rob Holding from that group either. I think, you know, he'll play games in the cup competition, certainly. I can't quite get away from this question of, is that going to be enough for him to be happy, enough for the club to be content about the contractual situation? I'd love to think that a quick decision could be made, and I'd love to think that decision would be a positive one. But that I'm not optimistic of. I feel like for the player, games will be instructive.
Sure. Sure. It feels like the ball is being knocked back and forward between the two courts at the moment, between Arsenal and Saliba. Yeah. And I guess we'll just find out when preseason starts and how involved he is and what the manager says about him and everything else. Let me ask you this one, because we're doing questions obviously throughout. And let me see if I can find this one. It's a bit of an either or question, but I'm not sure.
If it's about Yoda's manservant or whatever it is. I can't say anymore.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
The houseboy. I can't say anymore.
We will keep those plot details under wraps for now. Semper Fi Arsenal, at Semper Fi Arsenal, says, if given a choice, would you go for Zinchenko or Tielemans? And I just thought this was quite interesting because I don't know how much there is in the links to Zinchenko. An interesting player, I think. But I wanted to just ask you about that, if that's something you think is potentially a possibility. But the idea, I guess, is that Zinchenko could play in midfield. And I was looking at his stats for Manchester City this season, and pretty much every single appearance for Manchester City this season has been at left back, which is also interesting because, you know, you reported Nuno Tavares, they're considering maybe a loan for him next season. Zinchenko, if he can play midfield but also play at left back, there's that versatility we're talking about again. Because we all have a little bit of concern over Kieran Tierney and his ability to stay the course during a season. So I don't want to put you on the spot with the either or, but do you think there's genuine interest, or does that make sense that there might be some interest in Zinchenko?
Well, it makes sense to me, as in, if you ask me as a fan, you know, do I think he's an interesting player and do I think he fulfills a need within the squad? Then I would say, yeah. So from a sort of technical level, in terms of, is there legitimate interest in the player? Some, but not loads, would be how I would phrase that. Wait till you see that tweeted out by the aggregator sites. Some, but not loads, says James McNicholas. I mean, Mikel Arteta really likes Zinchenko as a player, and he's worked with him a lot. And often, you know, if Arteta likes a player, that's a massive... factor in whether or not they end up at Arsenal. There's two things that sort of count against it. One is that his role within the squad, that sort of left-backy role at the current time is not the highest priority. I think it's not something they're like actively, hugely pursuing at this point in time. And then the other element is financial. So the problem when you buy a Manchester City player is that they are expensive. They can charge pretty much what they want in terms of transfer fees, and they usually arrive on very healthy salaries. And the issue you would have with Zinchenko is that if you kind of aggregate his transfer fee and his wages, he would cost you what a starting player costs you. And then the question is he a starter in this team? And that is the sort of debate that will be going on about that player.
Okay.
But I think I sort of get that, you know, the cost thing. I mean, I think he's, as a sort of plug and play option, a guy who can play left back, a guy who can play central midfield, I think he makes a ton of sense. But is he going to play for you in your best 11? I don't know.
I don't know either, but yeah. Interesting one. We had one from Maddie the Goon who said, oh, this was 6 days ago. I don't know how I've seen this. But he said, is Zinchenko really only on 20 grand a week? Are those numbers correct?
No idea.
No idea. No idea. Seems low for a Manchester City player, to be honest.
Could be low. I mean, he arrived there very young.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, you know, a heralded star or anything like it. I thought it was interesting. I was doing some reading, and Arsene Wenger apparently really liked him when he was a 17-year-old and wanted to bring him over to Arsenal, but it didn't happen ultimately.
Right.
So there is a bit of history there. I think he's an excellent player. He was fantastic against Scotland in Ukraine's World Cup playoff. And, you know, I think he would... That question of is he starter, I sort of think with the amount of games we're having to face, I'm not sure that is the question, really. Do you know what I mean? I sort of think there's going to be games for everybody. It's the same with Saliba, you know. If we have three centre-halves, listen, they'll all play. If we have two left-backs or two left-eights, they'll play. I would really like it. he's a signing that I would really like. I just think bringing people in from top cultures where they're winning things, he's always healthy, he's got great technical ability, he's the right kind of age.
Yeah.
Ticks a lot of my boxes, but I don't get the sense that at this point in the window, Arsenal are sort of beating down the door for Zinchenko. Okay. I think there's admiration there, but it's not the current priority. Priority is going to be my word of the window.
Right. Basically. And priority, of course, is striker and central midfield.
Serge Gnabry, obviously.
Serge Gnabry, yes, of course.
No, I think it's interesting, that question of priority, because essentially a lot of the time I'm asked, like, are Arsenal interested in this player? Do they like this player? And so much of the time, the answer is yes. Like, there are good players out there, then you can bet your bottom dollar Arsenal are watching them or interested in them or even talking to their agents. It's just a question of priority. And I think also there's a kind of chronology to a window, and I think there are some big empty boxes that Arsenal feel the need to tick first and foremost. And I think that's where their energies are focused.
All right. Well, here's a question from Willisham Saliba, who's that dope gooner.
Okay.
And he said, how worried are you about Gabriel Jesus potentially going to Spurs or Real Madrid? There were some reports from Spain that Real Madrid were interested.
I have to say, the Real Madrid one, I went, ooh, that's not ideal. If that's true, and I don't know at this point. But Spurs, I'm like, yeah. I think we chatted about this before. I'm not as convinced his role within the Spurs team is as defined as or as high profile as it would be at Arsenal.
Agree.
Look at the strikers they've already got. Real Madrid, I just think for a Brazilian player, moving to a Mediterranean country, the climate, I mean, let's not leave out the fact they just won the Champions League. They're not a bad side. That would be some serious competition, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it would, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it would. I mean, the thing you'd say about transfer rumours from Spain is that they do have not football, but sports newspapers to fill every single day, and two of them are Madrid-based, you know, primarily focused on Real Madrid.
Sure. They've got a lot of content to produce.
They do have a lot to put out there, and a lot of stuff comes out of Spain, and, you know, it's like,
I'm sure they admire Gabriel Jesus, but is he a priority?
I don't know if he's their priority.
I don't know. I'm sort of quietly confident on Jesus. I feel like there's enough plausible reasons for him to want to come that it doesn't feel like pie in the sky. It feels like something we could do. But another club coming in, like Real Madrid, would obviously make that much more challenging.
How soon do you think that something like that could happen? Because let me just double check the Brazil fixtures, because they're playing some games. Brazil fixtures. I don't know what Brazil fixtures are there. Let's see. Oh, they're playing. Oh, they play Japan. They play Japan today.
Did Tomiyasu play?
I don't know. I'm just going to have a look at it now and see if I can find teams.
1-0. They won Neymar 1-0. Penalty.
Right. Teams. No, Tomiyasu did not play.
That's for the best.
That's good. Gabriel Martinelli got on?
Yes, as did Gabriel Jesus, who did not start. How soon? I'd be guessing, honestly. I have no idea.
But by the looks of it, I think that's their last fixture. So if their international commitments are done and dusted, and the guy wants to go and, you know, have a nice holiday, you know, put his feet up, probably get a, you know, deck chair at Bridlington, something like that, you know, dip his toes into the North Sea, soak up the rays, all that kind of stuff. He's gonna want to have his future sorted out before that, isn't he? You know, packing his suitcase, the handkerchief to tie around his head, all that kind of stuff. He's gonna want you know, it's sorted out. He doesn't want a saga, so maybe something will happen soon.
That'd be nice. I mean, that's what we all want, really. You know, you talk about clubs like Real Madrid. A lot of these big European clubs, Jesus might not be their number one target, but he might be their two or three. And what you don't want to do is wait until it gets to the end of the window and clubs are starting looking down at two or three on their list. You know, he's Arsenal's absolute priority. He is their number
priority,
one
target. Say, yeah?
Yeah. I used the word that time. Wasn't afraid to. So I think hopefully they can get some movement on that. That would be great, in my opinion. He's another player that I think would be an excellent addition.
I agree. I'd really like that signing. And it's one of those where I feel like, you know, if we could get that one done, it'd be a really good start to our summer business.
It would be a fillip. Yeah,
everyone's, you know, people are growing a little bit anxious, even though the window's only just open and everything else, and there's still a long way to go, and the summer's only just begun, et cetera, et cetera. Nevertheless, the anxiety levels, I sense, you know, from seeing things online and what have you, like it might just calm people down a little bit if we filled one of the key roles that needs to be filled.
Yeah, I think that's fair. By the way, I never really answered the question about Zinchenko versus Tielemans. Yeah. And just to say, sort of, I guess it was sort of evident, but the button on that would be that I think Tielemans probably is a starter in this team. At least I think that's the intention. So I think, again, to use the priority word, I think that bumps him up Arsenal's list a little bit.
It is an interesting concept. Not an interesting concept, like Tielemans coming in as a starter, you know. He's 24. Is he 24 years of age? 25 years of age?
Something like that would be a
fairly substantial signing, 25. Given that we're going to buy him from another Premier League club, and we've talked about this ad infinitum, you know. But he starts in place of Granit Xhaka. And I know you've spoken about this. I think we've spoken about it before on the podcast. Like, I don't think Xhaka is a happy substitute or a guy who is looking for a diminished role at the club or any club that he would be at. I think he, you know, is that kind of guy. He wants to play. He wants to start. He wants to do his stuff. And, I mean, do you think that might have an effect on Xhaka's future? I mean, I personally,
Xhaka's going to play up front, Andrew. That's the
is that what it is? He's our plan B.
Gabriel just goes to Real Madrid. Xhaka as a false nine.
He's going to be the Paul Warhurst of this season. Is that what you're saying?
I don't have any concrete information that suggests Xhaka's going, but I've written about it and talked about my little hunch that it could happen. And you do wonder about it. I mean, I agree completely with your point that he's not a natural substitute.
No.
You know, whether or not you think his ability is deserving of substitute status, unfortunately, it's not hugely compatible with his personality, I suspect. So that would be an interesting thing to manage.
Would like the dominoes falling kind of situation, if you want to put it like that, is if Tielemans comes in and Xhaka is like, I don't think he's going to shirk any kind of challenge or anything like that, but he won't also be blind to the reality of the situation that he's a guy who's heading towards 30. They've signed a 24, 25 year old player who's a little bit more creative, I think you would say. You know, a different kind of profile for that left eight, that advanced left eight. So, you know, it's not that there wouldn't be football for him, but maybe he might think, okay, well, look, I've done my time here. This could be the way, or this could be the time for me to go. Does that then maybe put more credence in the Zinchenko thing? That might be part of why there are links to him. Like, then you get your left eight backup / left back guy, and you add depth in two positions with one player.
Could be, but I don't. Mm. I don't know that to be true, basically, but it's possible.
I'm just speculating, obviously.
Yeah, if Xhaka were to go, then I think Zinchenko really makes a ton of sense, right? Because he plays in all the same areas, essentially, whether it's in left back or in central midfield. He's doing a similar job in that Man City team. When he plays left back, he spends half the game in central midfield anyway. So he's operating in all the same zones as Xhaka. So I think as a kind of Xhaka replacement, he makes, a ton of sense. But I think that would, like you say, need Xhaka to go. Well, the interesting thing about Xhaka, like, and Tielemans coming in, would that make Xhaka rethink his future? I don't know, because like you say, I think he would back himself in any contest, and I think he would be up for the challenge. And the other thing to say is that, you know, if he were to stay this summer and then play less than ideal or less than he wanted, he would just move on in the future. You know, I think Xhaka, whether or not Xhaka stays this summer, I'm not sure he'll be at Arsenal in 2 years' time. I think whatever happens, he's not part of the long-term future of the club just because of the age, really. And unlike Saliba, he's not in a position where he has to decide now. You know, it's not like it's going to cost him his place with Switzerland. You know, I think he has a bit more space around his decision than Saliba does. Saliba's really in this like crucible, you know, where it feels like this kind of sliding doors moment for him. I don't think the same is true to the same extent of Xhaka. But it's a really interesting one. Because, I just have this hunch. I just can't foresee a scenario where Xhaka's just like on the bench. Just maybe that's just because we've never seen it before.
But you know what as well? I don't know that that's a good role for him anyway.
Right.
If that makes sense. He strikes me as the kind of guy who needs to play.
Yeah, I
regularly,
can't imagine,
you know,
bringing
what I mean?
Him on as a sub. But I mean, we have seen it. Do you remember? I think there was a cup game at home to Newcastle once where he came on and absolutely bossed it, turned the game around.
I can't remember.
The one where Smith Rowe was sent off. But but I know what you mean. He's not an impact substitute, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a guy who's going to come on and like inject a load of pace and energy into a game. And no. I think probably for you know, his best periods come when he plays regularly. He's got the rhythm and everything else. And I wonder as well if some of the slight flaws in his game might be exacerbated by a role where he is maybe in his own mind looking to prove himself or show what he can do or, you know, be
super
committed.
You know, not quite got that tempo.
Exactly, yeah.
I think that's probably true. And as he gets older, that probably would only be further exacerbated.
It is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's an argument from the club side that they should sell Xhaka now, that it's the right time, that his value is decent. He's got a little bit left on his contract. He's at the age where, you know, he's probably past his peak at this point in time. You can make a very cogent case that this is the point to get some money back on Granit Xhaka. I'm just not sure Mikel Arteta will see it like that, given how important to him we know Xhaka has been historically.
But again, you know, if you're telling a player how important he is by going out and signing somebody to play in his position, There is the rub, of course. And those
even,
are
even moving to that system, in my opinion, was a bit of a
agree.
Sort of water, like a move away from Xhaka, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially, you're playing him in, out of position, really, in the second half of the season.
Well, you're asking him to do a job that is not necessarily his natural job. And to be fair, I think he did it pretty well. I think he did it pretty well for the most part. But it does tell you that, you know, maybe they're looking to do something a little bit different. Okay, look, we're going to take a break here because we've reached the end of part one. We're going to do more of your questions in part two. So stick with us. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer the questions that you sent to us on Twitter, at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. And just to give you a heads up, myself and James will be doing a waffle podcast this week over on Patreon. This is the podcast in which we take your questions and answer anything and everything about anything and everything except Arsenal. I got there in the end. I got myself tied up a little bit with that one. So you can find that at patreon.com/arsblog. We'll have that for you midweek there, thereabouts. Right. Do you want to go? Do you want to go first in part two?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
So this question is from AJ, who's at UFGoonerAJ on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And AJ says, do you think, it's interesting actually, I guess it's a bit of a follow on maybe from the Xhaka conversation. Do you think experience can be overrated as an intangible quality? Sometimes we point to poor performances from veteran players and say we should expect better from an experienced pro. But at some point, if you lack elite talent, perhaps the experience can't cover it that much.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. But what makes mistakes from experienced players more frustrating is the idea that, you know, you can learn and you can make mistakes, and every player makes mistakes, but you should be able to learn from them. And when a guy who's 21, 22, 19, whatever it is, if he gets something wrong, you can say, look, you've got to do better there. But next time you experience that situation, next time that scenario comes up, remember the time it went wrong and do it differently, right? Mm. But when you've got a guy who's 26, 27, 28, 29, maybe older than that, and they make the same mistake time and time again, or they do the same things over and over again, I think you can in some way put it down to not being elite talent, but you also have to put it down to them just being unable or unwilling to learn from what's happened before. You know, a guy, a central defender, for example, not naming any names, you know, could be anyone, could be literally anyone who just goes, I don't know, sliding in, doesn't stay
on
the
street. I haven't got anyone specific in mind.
I'm just throwing it out there as a completely random example. But that guy who then goes to ground and the attacker waltzes past him and scores a goal or creates a chance or whatever it is. And then a few games later, that same central defender does exactly the same thing. I'm not sure that's a talent issue as much as a brain issue. Do you know what I mean? And I do think that you can benefit from experience without being an elite talent. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Think about someone like, who's a good example of this? James Milner, maybe. A really good example of this. Who I thought, you know, is a decent player, but as he's got older and the experiences that he's had, where was he? He was at Man City. Where was he before Man City? Was it Aston Villa?
Leeds, Aston Villa.
Aston Villa. You know, he's a player who, at every club he went to, learned how to develop his game, even when other aspects of it were diminishing, like his physicality or his pace or whatever it is. When you get older, obviously that is something you have to contend with. But he was smart, you know, and was able to read the game and able to use his experience to his benefit. I don't think you would say he is an elite talent, a very good player, but like, you know, he's not like a Dennis Bergkamp or Thierry Henry or a Mo Salah or anyone like that. But what he has done over the course of his career is learn the game.
I think you nailed it because you said he's smart. And
yeah, like I said, it's a brain issue.
I guess experience does have a value, but I think it is still possible we overvalue it. It's not in itself that valuable. Like if you have played 500 games, but you're not intelligent enough to kind of process that accordingly and improve and on your mistakes, then that experience has no real value. So it's only really worth anything in conjunction with other qualities that make you able to apply that experience.
I agree. Yeah.
But you know, a lot of footballers do have those. That's why they are professional footballers, you know, because they've shown that all through their careers from when they were 12, 13 years old. They've been able to learn from situations and put that into practice. So I think for most footballers, experience does have a benefit, but only really because of other attributes that you have at your disposal.
I think you know, intelligence is the one that really benefits you as you get older, and how you can how you understand your own game as well. It's not just about what's going on around you. It's about knowing what you can do and what you're capable of and what you're capable of producing. And I suppose that also works in conjunction with whatever coach or manager you have who can see the qualities that you can bring to a team.
Yeah, and also you've got to bear in mind, what if you imagine it like a graph, like as that experience line is kind of going up diagonally, you've got a couple of others that are heading most likely in the other direction, which are your physical traits and capacity and perhaps potentially your motivation as well.
That's true.
You know, you're kind of working against that. So I think it does have a value, but I think the original question, was it AJ? I'll say AJ is an interesting one because I think it's certainly arguable that we do overvalue it. Or at least we attribute too much to pure experience when actually other qualities are what sort of they perform the alchemy that turns that experience into improvement.
Yes, yes, great way of putting it. Okay, here's one from the Discord from Payne992, who says, who do you think will improve the most next season?
Which Arsenal player?
I guess so, yeah, because we don't care about any other kind of players, do we?
That's a good question. Who will improve the most?
Who's going to get the most improved player prize at the end of the season?
I'm going to say a very boring answer. I'm going to say Bukayo Saka.
Right.
Because I know he's our best player. And I know he's probably going to be our player of the season. But he is, how old? Let me have a look. 20. And given the nature of his talent and his age, I think we're on the cusp of him potentially exploding beyond even what he's already done. And I think he could go from a good player in this Arsenal team to one of the unquestionable stars of this league. Mm. And that's maybe a bigger jump, say, than someone who's kind of not doing that well now, but, you know, is sort of moderately capable next season. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's a high bar, you know, because he has obviously been so good. Can you hear these fucking... Can you hear that?
No, what is it?
Hang on. Bastards.
Chilling.
Outside my window.
Absolutely chilling.
They're fighting out there, magpie bastards. I've got two in mind.
Okay.
One is Gabriel Martinelli. Mm-hmm. Because I think he did improve last season, but I feel like there's still something to click, if you know what I mean, in terms of his end product. I think he had respectable-ish numbers in the end. There was like six or seven assists in the end, which is not bad, but I think he's capable of more. Some of the positions that he gets himself into, I think he is capable of more.
The way he looked when he first came into the team around kind of Christmas time, you think of that Leeds game.
Mm.
There were a few games around that time where you thought, if he keeps playing like this, you know, his numbers come the end of the season are going to be amazing.
Yeah.
And he didn't quite sustain that productivity. So I think that's a good shout. Who was the other one?
Ben White. Who I think had a really good season, and clearly Mikel Arteta thinks very, very highly of Ben White. You know, I just feel like his first season at the club had a difficult start, but you know, settled in well and became an important player. I just feel like he's got that jump in him as well. You know, there are a few, though, as well. You know, you could look at Ramsdale. You could look at Gabriel. You could look at Martin Odegaard. You know, players mm-hmm. who are definitely capable of giving us more than we got this season, which isn't to downplay what they did, but I think we saw the potential. We saw evidence of the talent, and we saw evidence of the ability, and now it's about producing it. The consistent application of that, if you know what I mean. And they're all still pretty young. White is 24, Odegaard's 23, Gabriel 23, you know, Martinelli's early 20s as well. So those would be the ones that I would pick.
I mean, what's interesting about all those players, maybe all players pretty much in this Arsenal team, is that they have really shown a top level of performance at some stage.
Mm.
The question is, can they produce that consistently? There's some really but you know, I find that exciting and interesting about this group, that we can name so many players potentially with this room to improve, and that's what you get when you've got a young and talented group. You know, last summer we were all sat here saying, well, we're going to need more from Smith Rowe, we're going to need more from Martinelli, we're going to need more from Saka, and we got it.
Yeah.
And
same again. Let's do it again,
same
boys.
Same again, please. Yeah. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
What about this? Suburban Gooner Chris said, Arteta said he wanted 22 outfield players and 3 keepers. Will any of the Hale End lads that haven't broken through yet, and he mentions Patino, Hutchison, Aziz, make up that list? I don't know. I know they don't have to from a homegrown perspective, but could it be seen as a promotion and therefore make up numbers?
I mean, you don't quite know what's going to happen in preseason. A guy can come in and play some good games and sort of thrust themselves into the reckoning in a way that you're not quite expecting. But I think those three in particular, I mean...
I like what I've seen of Brooke Norton Cuffey. I do have to say
yes.
that.
Did you watch the video, actually? There was a good video on the...
No,
the,
was it good?
Yeah. It's only like 6 or 7 minutes on the Arsenal, the official Arsenal player. I think it's probably on the YouTube as well, the Arsenal YouTube. It is well worth a look because he talks really well about going on loan and his place in the team at Lincoln City and what he wants to do and how he wants to play and how he approached that loan. So I think, yeah, he's an interesting one for the future, isn't he?
Definitely. Whether or not it's this season, I don't know.
Yeah, but we don't quite know. And I think I don't want to go down the right back road too far. But, you know, that is maybe an area where we can see an improvement beyond our first choice player when he's fully fit or when he's not fully fit. You know what I mean? So certainly one for the future. And maybe he's somebody who could benefit from some Europa League games. The others, I just feel like they need to go and play regular football somewhere against, and this is what Norton Cuffey said, was to go and play against men, to play against men. And it's different. You know, you can be a great player at under 18, under 23 level, but you're playing against guys your own size. You're playing against, you know, players who physically aren't at their peak. You know, you're not fully developed. You're not as strong as you are. You're not as muscular as you're going to be, all that kind of stuff. And probably, let's face it, when you go and play for a lower league team, you're playing against guys or playing with guys who, you know, who are, this is their job and this is their livelihood. And a lot depends on their job and their livelihood. And they'll do whatever it takes, you know, whether it's to take your place in the team or whether it's to kick you out of a game to make sure that they win and they get their win bonus for their team, which is, you know, valuable to them and their income at the end of the day. So there's a lot more at stake when you're playing this kind of football. And I feel like those guys need to go and experience that before we can really start talking about them as first team prospects for us, you know, because they all look like Patino physically, I think, has got a bit of a way to go. Omari Hutchinson looks a really, really exciting player. But again, let him go run at some grizzled veteran fullbacks in the Championship. Or I think there was some talk of him going to Reading, wasn't there?
It had been mentioned.
Yeah, you know, so let him go and get those games in. So I don't rule out the idea that somebody from the academy could make the step up next season. Maybe somebody we're not quite expecting. But for those guys in particular, I think they need to go and play more regular football before we can really think about them as Arsenal players.
Yeah, I think if one stays around, I think it might be Patino. And part of the reason is that for that is I'm not sure he's ready to go out physically. You know, you speak about what it's like playing against men. I think if you look at him and his physical development, I sort of think it'd be too soon to send him to get booted all over the Championship. I think that, you know, he's a bit more of a late bloomer physically, and I think they might want to keep him close where his development can be kind of monitored and managed, and that might come later for him.
I mean, he's still only 18.
One guy who wasn't mentioned there, we had another question about it from Our Little Mozart on Twitter, says, "Goodly evening. What role do you envision Fuller and Balogun playing next season? With Eddie being given a new contract, do you see him getting minutes in Europa and domestic cup competitions, or would another loan be best for his development?"
That is an interesting one. Because
tough one, that.
Because, you know, two strikers isn't really enough. It's not really enough for a whole season of domestic and European football and maybe cup football as well.
Yeah.
So do we bring in another striker?
Is it two, though? Is, you know, if you think of Martinelli...
Well, yeah, I mean, though, I was going to say, yeah, Martinelli could be used as a striker, and there's, you know, you and your Smith Rowe false nine agenda.
Well,
you
know? Yeah, exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, will they see it as two, or will they think we've got, as long as we've got variety and numbers in that sort of front three, we might be okay.
It's a tricky one,
Balogun, because he's been out on loan. You know, he's not torn it up, has he, at Middlesbrough? But he's done well enough.
I wonder if he is perhaps a potential January loan, whereby, you know, you keep him around for the group stages of the Europa League. You keep him around for the EFL Cup, and hopefully you get a few favourable draws in the early rounds of that competition, you know? And that means you can give guys like him some playing time, and certainly Europa League, he's got to be in with a shout there, and then he gives you some depth. And then you see where you are in January, depending on how he's done and how often you think he's going to play.
I think that's probably... To be honest, they might hold on to a few of these kids until January because of the Europa League and the possibility that they're, and the League Cup as well, and the possibility that they'll get minutes there. And they have that luxury, you know, where they can kind of wait and see and then send them out in January. I think if you look back over our last few seasons, quite often these young players, they're held on to in August and then allowed to go out in January when the playing group is a bit more condensed and a bit more clear.
Yeah, yeah. It will be interesting to see what they do with some of these young players. But I think for most of them, they're not quite there yet. Balogun, maybe, and he has had some moments in the first team for Arsenal and scored a couple of goals. So he's probably the closest to I suppose, getting minutes in the first team without having to go out again. But it wouldn't surprise me if there was another loan for him. In January. Here's one from Simon Party King on the Discord. He says, goodly morning, gents. It's goodly evening at this point. He said, can we talk a bit about KSE? With the Saudis in the ring, obviously at Newcastle, they're more important than ever at keeping us relevant through investment. For the first time since they took over 100%, they seem to have an executive in place with the club as their priority, and we're seeing improvements and positive planning, no doubt to try and deflect from the whole Super League thing. My question is, do you think KSE have turned a corner, or is it just clear that more club-focused people need to be put in at executive level to keep us on the course that Arteta and Edu have us on now?
Oh, that's a big question, isn't it? I mean, I think that there is a marked change in the way KSC engage with Arsenal since they took 100% control. I'm not saying it's been all positive since then, but I think if you look at their expenditure and the day-to-day involvement of someone like Josh Kroenke, there's been an uptick in both of those things since that point. I still think that the nature of KSC is that they're sort of very dependent on making the right appointments, essentially. They do put a great deal of trust in the people they choose to run the club. And they're, you know, if you get that right, it's great. And if you get it wrong, it's not. It feels like there is a good chemistry among the kind of executive team now. They're a young group. They want to prove themselves. And crucially, I mean, I'm not sure if KSE have improved or we've just got a manager who's very good at managing upwards, because I think it's really healthy that the owners seem to really buy into Arteta, because I think that creates sort of leverage for him in conversations about transfers and squad building and things like that. And I think that, I would say that they are more engaged, and they are, I guess, performing slightly better as owners. But I think it's also about the chemistry that exists between them and the executive group, including the manager in that, and the fact that relationship seems positive and healthy is a positive and healthy thing for the club. I mean, you have to remember Arsenal is a club that where it's been sort of beset by essentially civil war for a long time. I don't like using war terminology, but I mean, in terms of the kind of the unrest between Usmanov and Kroenke, that's an incredibly unhealthy thing for a club. And then also in the latter years of Arsene Wenger, I don't think there was a unified sense from the board or the executives that everyone was pulling in the same direction and everybody knew where the club was headed at that time. And I think there is much more of a semblance of that at this point. I just don't quite know how to apportion the credit for it.
Sure.
What, I mean. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I have to think that they learned from the post-Arsene stuff that went on, where maybe the decision-making was not as good as it should have been. You know, we talked about it, but you know, when you're looking to replace not just someone like Arsene Wenger, but also your longstanding chief executive, do you just go to the next guy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you do. I think you've got to be better than that. You've got to be smarter than that. And I think that
yeah, you didn't give Steve Bould the managerial job. Do you know what I mean? So
yeah,
that kind of rigor should be applied.
Yeah. And I think that is something that has been missing at executive level for a while. And you've got to find that balance between their involvement and them making sure that the people who are involved know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And are the best possible people. Because like you wouldn't say Roman Abramovich, this is a terrible example, obviously, given everything that's going on, but Roman Abramovich wasn't a football guy, but he got the best football people he could find at executive level. He kept them around for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure.
Yeah, Marina Granovskaya, you know, was incredibly influential at that club. I'm not sure if she's staying post-takeover.
I don't quite know what's happening.
His people, right? Bruce Buck, who he'd worked with for many years, Granovskaya.
Exactly.
And I think one of the interesting developments in recent years with the Kroenkes is, you know, the appointment of Tim Lewis. I do think that is quite a interesting development because he's very much their guy and he's in a very influential position at Arsenal right now. And I just think that kind of direct line, again, is probably on balance a beneficial thing and sort of seems to be helping with things like oversight from an ownership level, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they were hands off with Arsene Wenger because he had a track record of success. And he had a profile and a status within Arsenal Football Club that in many ways just sort of demanded that. Whether that was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, that's up to every individual listening to this. But you can understand why it happened. But that approach then subsequently was not good. You know, just to sort of go, well, Ivan said that Ryle's a good guy, we should go with that. I don't think that is the right way, particularly at a time when the football club was in a period of flux anyway, which happens when you lose a sort of long-standing manager like Wenger. I think you really have to sit down and strategize. And that, I suppose, is one of the most encouraging things of the last 18 months or so, where it feels, even if some of the decisions made during Mikel Arteta's tenure weren't always up to scratch, you always felt like he was focused on improvement at every level. Did he get everything right? No. But at the heart of it, that's what he said he wanted and that's what he was trying to do. So you had that as sort of like the building blocks of where you wanted to go. People wanted more engagement and more input from them. They've got some more of that. You know,
I mean, the original question, I think, said, you know, is this all kind of appeasement for the Super League? And listen, I'm sure there's an element of that. And I've said this all along, but I think that the Amazon documentary, for example, I'd be amazed if Josh Kroenke is not positioned very positively within that. And, you know, and much like the interviews he gave at the start of the season, there's a lot of talk to try and repair some of the damage that was done, for some people is completely unforgivable, the Super League. And, sure. I hear that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he does talk well, to be fair. He comes across, I would say he comes across like a guy who's trying to mend some fences. You know what I mean? When he talks about the club, and like, why shouldn't he come across like that? Because he should, you know, but...
I think they were genuinely shocked, actually. And I think at the scale of the response, and I think the fact that they were genuinely shocked, unfortunately, slightly lays bare a lack of kind of cultural appreciation of Arsenal as an institution and what it means more broadly. But I think my sense is they were really taken aback, and they did not anticipate that scale of displeasure and anger. And
I think that might be true of all the owners, to be honest, because I think they've, over the years, they've been able to do whatever they want without a great deal of pushback, or certainly not the concerted, coordinated pushback that came from fans of all clubs who were involved in that and went, no, fuck this. You know, that was really a powerful thing. And I know it's been, not that it's been overlooked, but I do wish that we could see a bit more of that in certain ways when it comes to football and when it comes to things like this, that, you know, we can hate you when we play you and we can hate you all season long. But at the end of the day, if they're trying to fuck you and they're trying to fuck me and they're trying to fuck that guy, if we all get together and, you know, don't let them or make it difficult for them to do that, then we all benefit from that. And I can still hate you and I can still hate you, but like together we've fucked off these load. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I imagine they were sort of sat there scratching their heads thinking, well, all you guys say you want Arsenal in the biggest European competition. We were just trying to give you that forever. But it's still such a, what's the word? It's so misguided. And I think that there is an element to which they, you know, accept there's sort of reparations to be made after that. But also, it is their business. It is their investment. It is their money, ultimately. And they want to make the best of it. What the extent of their ambition is, I think, is a difficult thing to be sure of.
That's going to be really interesting. I think this is a very
interesting... How far do they want to go?
Yeah, genuinely, how committed are you to competing with Man City, with what Newcastle could potentially become?
Surely not committed to competing with Saudi Arabia? I mean...
I know, but like, what do you do then? Like, what is your approach? Do you just say, well, we're never going to be able to compete on a financial level, but that doesn't mean you can't bridge the gap or you know... And we've talked about the Liverpool thing. I think we spoke about that last week as well, where if you do get things right, if you do get the right players, if you do get the right manager, you know, you can, by most measures, achieve... Here we go back again, trying to redefine success and what have you. But, like, isn't the thing that people say, you know, if we're competitive, if we're competing, if we get to the business end of the season and we're in with a shout and we just fall short, then as frustrating as that would be, you know, at least we were there. We were, you know, we did our best. Can't win them all that kind of stuff. Like, I know we all want to win. I know we all want to see the Premier League lifted again. I get that. But really, isn't it about being competitive on a consistent basis and making sure that you're involved in the conversations for the biggest trophies? And then how you do that, I don't know what you do as an ownership. I mean, they are billionaires at the end of the day, so...
Yeah, sure. I mean, they're not short of a bob or two. I guess you're right. I think, you know, even if from a kind of financial, economic perspective, the aim is, well, stay in major European competitions and pick up those revenues... sounds horrible, but you can't really aim for that, as in you've sort of got to shoot higher than that if that's going to be your consistent bread and butter. You got to aim higher than that, and you got to aim for the stars, miss and hit the moon, basically.
Right, right. Do we have another couple? I'm sure we do.
Oh, yeah. I've got one.
Okay.
We've done a lot of sort of should they stay or should they go about loan players, but Shazwan on the Discord says, should Nuno go on loan?
I could see how it would be beneficial.
I mean, do we know enough about Nuno yet? My feeling about Nuno is I still don't really know.
I have a gut.
What we've got.
I agree, but I sort of have a gut feeling that I kind of know. Do you know what I mean? Right. And I'm not trying to be disparaging. I just you know, I've seen some things. Like, I think there are some positive aspects to his game, but I think there are some flaws there that, like, I hope they can iron out on the training ground. It would be great if they could, because he's a great athlete, isn't he? He's, you know, very physically imposing. He's quick. He gets forward. I mean, he can't shoot for shit, but he does give it a good try, to be fair. He gets himself in some good positions.
He gave a good interview, by the way. I don't know if you saw that.
I did see bits and pieces of it. I didn't see the whole thing, but I did see some bits and pieces. And I think the bit I saw, he was talking about how his confidence during the season took a big hit. And I do wonder if, you know, we were talking about experience earlier and how beneficial is experience. How beneficial is confidence? Or how detrimental is a lack of confidence for a player? And I think the answer is quite detrimental indeed, you know? So with Europa League group stage and with cup games and everything else, you know, unless the whole Tielemans, Xhaka, Zinchenko house of cards comes to pass, then, you know, why not keep him? Why not keep him and give him those games and see what he can do and give him more time? And if you're in a position where in January you're thinking, well, this hasn't gone the way we want, or he hasn't quite made the progress we want, you've got the ability to do something that month.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it. I think keep him until January. I reported they're considering a loan. It's certainly something they've discussed for him and that it might be the best thing for his development. But I do wonder if that will be held until January. That's what I would do. I think there's a good opportunity for him to pick up minutes. And I think we just about do need to see some more minutes. We've seen some really good stuff and some really bad stuff. And I think I just need like a bit more time to kind of gauge which of those is the dominant force.
Yeah, I mean, you could see a little less good stuff, a little less bad stuff, and something more in the middle, you know, in terms of consistency of performance and what have you. I mean, there are definitely some ingredients there. I just don't know how they all go together. If they can come together and cook up a delicious Nuno meal, you know.
And it may come down to that aspect of intelligence that we were talking about in part one, was it? Or a start of part two, rather. You know, does he have the tools to kind of synthesize his experience and improve accordingly? And does he have the support around him, the coaching around him to help him do that?
Yeah.
That's going to be the challenge.
Let's see. Okay, we've got one here from the Discord from Stuart, and this is quite interesting because there was talk about a story about Mike Riley last week, who's the head of the PGMOL, and he said, any optimism that the quality and standards of refereeing will improve next season, or will we still endure the tedium of inconsistency, bias, incompetence, baffling decisions being played by cheats and England captains, etc., etc.? And like, you know, I have had my struggles with VAR and some of the decisions made at Premier League level that I wasn't convinced were happening elsewhere. But we talked about the playoff final last week, remember? Mm-hmm. And the penalties that Huddersfield didn't get. The one that Ukraine didn't get against Wales?
Wow.
What the fuck is going on with that? How is that even possible in a VAR era? I don't get it.
It does seem strange. If you're going to have the technology for precisely those situations, kind of absurd that it's not applied correctly. I mean, look, it's not my favourite topic, referees, but I couldn't say with any confidence that I think performances will improve. I don't know what basis there is to believe that. Experience, I guess, Andrew.
Well, they're gone.
All these referees are going to be more experienced.
No, all the experienced ones are gone. John Moss is gone. Mike Dean is gone. Who's the other one?
There's well, maybe that's good. Maybe we'll get some elite refereeing talent through instead.
They just needed a break. They just needed, you know, those guys to step out of the way. They can.
The Willian referees have all been shuffled off the refereeing coil, and the Bukayo Sakas are about to break through.
Yeah.
I'd love to believe that.
I mean, I would love to see some significant change at PGMOL. I really would.
What would that look like?
Well, firing Mike Riley for a start. Because he's been there too long, and, you know, this is basically his own personal fiefdom.
It's like a firm, isn't it? You know, like, there's been a lot of talk about the royal family in this country this weekend, and there's that old saying, like, don't mess with the firm. And that's what the PGMOL is like.
Don't mess with the firm.
Yeah, it feels like they...
It's a closed shop.
They close ranks, yeah. Essentially.
And they're like they're like the cops, in a way.
Yeah. In a funny kind of way, they are. And I think the answer is for the kind of officiating discussion to be slightly more open and collaborative and working towards this idea of we accept mistakes happen and there's a human element and there will always be flaws and... But you know, I don't know, something more collaborative that involved other football bodies or... Yeah, there's got to be a better way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a point that people make quite often is the lack of diversity in the refereeing pool.
Yeah.
A lot of guys from the Northwest.
I also think age as well, Andrew. Like, why is it that an elite athlete is at his peak at sort of 26, but we expect referees to be running around in their 40s doing this job? I don't know.
I guess there's an element of...
Experience.
Yeah, experience, but sort of seniority, like that person of authority. Like, I don't know, sometimes I walk down the street here in Dublin and you see some young Gardaí, the police here, and you see them walking down the road and they're like, you're like, this is a child. This person is a child. And they have the power to arrest me. You know, whatever it is. I do think there is something to that little bit of age difference, whether it gets... I mean, I don't know that it makes any big difference to a player. I think if a referee was a good referee and respected by the players, it wouldn't matter what age he was. But I wonder how you sell that role to young guys who, A, could be playing still or, you know, are... Mm. Yeah, maybe it's... It's a career path that I think is a difficult one to tread because, like, let's say you're a 26, 28-year-old guy and you decide to become a referee and you get through the process and all of a sudden you're a Premier League referee. I mean, I think there is an element of, you know, you're on television every week and there's, you know, close-ups of you and, like, all of a sudden... 60,000 people want to kill you because you've made a decision. I think those are things that are a little
There aren't many loved referees.
No. No. But, I mean, I think you can probably incentivize the work to the point where that isn't quite as big a factor. And I do wonder if, you know, maybe if you paid them better, if you had more diversity... If there was more accountability, if there was greater transparency in the whole refereeing process, I think you could build more faith with football fans that these guys aren't just fucking making it up on the spot and changing their minds on things from week to week to week. And that is, you know, the thing that drives people mad. You know, decisions are made and we never get an explanation. And the next week something happens and it's a completely different decision and we never get an explanation. So I do think there are things that they could do to improve, but certainly changing some of the people who are there at the moment, who have presided over a consistent decline in the standards of refereeing, even with the application of technology, which is designed specifically to help them get more decisions right, would be a very good start.
I agree. That would be nice.
I think that's it.
Yeah, I think that's it. We've set the world to rights, Andrew.
Exactly, exactly. We've got to get this out for the people to listen to, given that it is out later than usual. So apologies for that. Hopefully it was worth the wait. Join myself and James during the week for the Waffle Over on Patreon, and we will catch you on the next one.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.